Expo Bomb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
I'm hearing voices, animal voices, the tremor of cold, the feminine of this soon, reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
Well, hello everybody out there in the Afterrot land. Welcome to another exciting edition of Talking About Stuff, because stuff is interesting, stuff is fun. Tonight on the show, we have a guest by the name of Andrew Paul Wesson, who's been on before. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you for having me back. You must be crazy.
I am certifiably, maybe, I don't know, I can't say nothing, because nobody can prove nothing, because they don't got no records. Exactly.
Oh, we can make them up.
Well, they usually do, and so do I.
Yeah. Yep.
So, you have a new book coming out called
Hellhounds,
and it is a sequel to
Hellbound. Spot the link.
And is it set in the universe of?
It's set in the Heroes in Hell universe. I can go into it in depth if you want, but briefly put, Heroes in Hell.
Let's visit a little bit about the Heroes in Hell. And by the way, I know our lovely listeners all know that I've written some short stories in the Heroes in Hell series as well. I love the whole concept, and the whole what Janet Morris and Chris Morris have put together as far as that universe is awesome. But let's get a little bit of a spin on the Heroes in Hell universe from you.
Yeah, because I had to look into it myself when I first started there. It's a shared world of what they call Bangasian fantasy, isn't it? It's where you use famous literary or historical characters who carry on their whatever they like to do in the afterlife. From what I remember, the first 12 books were produced, in fact, by Bane Books, weren't they, from 1986 onwards?
That is correct.
And Janet resurrected the series in 2011. I think it was Lawyers in Hell,
yep.
Followed by Rogues and then Dreamers and so on, although there's been a few novels in between. A friend of ours, Michael, did Bridge Over Hell, which I enjoyed very much. And, of course, it's gone from there with, I think it was Dreamers, Poets and Doctors and so on. And that's, you know, roughly where I came in, Doctors in Hell, when I introduced the character Damon Grimm. But it's really interesting because, like, you know, these characters from history or from folklore or myth, you know, there's such a lot you can do with them. You know, in that type of setting, you know, because it's not just a Dantean setting. There's like there's a Greek tragedy aspect to it. So you know, you can make it poetically cruel. You can introduce elements of comedy and so on, which I try to do, because sometimes I think that, you know, it does make it more menacing when you have you know, that smiling assassin who, you know, kiss you on each cheek as they gut you.
Yes.
Yeah, so I quite enjoy it. It took a lot of homework to do, of course.
Homework before you started writing for that?
Oh yes.
Oh gosh.
Yeah, as you probably appreciate, you know, when you know, I'm something of a world builder.
Yes.
I with my other works and so on. And here, a lot of the world building aspect was done with it. I was coming into an already established universe, so in that respect, it was good. But then you can't do exactly what you do. There are rules to follow. Like for example, in Hellhounds, as we'll probably go on to chat, I do borrow other characters. I refer to Janet and Chris's Sabiti characters. The Sons of Heaven and Hell, they're the personified weapons of the Babylonian plague god Era. So they act in a certain way, they fight using certain methods. So if you refer to them, you have to obey the rules. You know, you can't just do your own thing. You have to use them in their context and keep them within their context, you know. So it keeps you on your toes a lot. So you have to do your homework to how they think, how they speak, how they act, how they interact with others. You know, so yes, it makes brain hurt doing homework, but in the end
makes
in the
brain
end, it's
hurt
good. Yes. What's left? What's not eaten?
Yeah.
But it's good fun. That's good fun because, again, it stretches you in other ways. So I've made sure to not only introduce my own characters, as it were, you know, through, because as you probably were, my Grimm character, although he was introduced in Doctors, I leapfrog his anthology adventures with the actual novels themselves. So they're all linked in time. They each take place a certain length of time after the other. So they're chronological. But then, it, you know, as I say, it makes you you know, you think, oh right, I've got to set that, You know, it makes you plan it out so that you can keep things within context. It's good fun.
So, from what I do know and remember of our discussion previous time, you're much more inclined towards planning out and like logically calling a sequence of this, then this, then this, then this, and okay, this relates to that, that relates to that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I like to plan things out, but then once the you know, I'm one of these weird ones. Once it gets going, you know, I like to make what I call a skeleton, if you like. It's the framework on which I'm going to build my story. But then as we're going along, sometimes it you know, turns into a mutant, because as you know, when you're writing, and it picks up the pace and develops that pace of its own and a flow, it sometimes leads off. So I think they call it panster, don't they? You know, you fly by the seat of your pants. So I allow it to go off, and because of that, certain characters have literally lived and died, or unlived and undied again within the story. So I let things flow. Once I see something good's developing, I go with it.
Well, it's what I call P&P.
Yeah.
Plot and pants.
Ah, yes.
So it's the mix. Most people do one or the other, and to a larger degree, most people try to do P&P, but most of them are stuck with one or the other.
So I just thought it was my split personality.
There you go. So one of the things I do like about the Hell universe and working with it is the concept of time.
Yes.
The technical term is there is no time in Hell, because essentially it's all of eternity. It's from the beginning to the end of eternity. So the backdrop you have to draw on to play with is like from even the caveman days to super future fantastic, hey, they've got UFOs already. These people and characters, you could have anybody who is technically gone to hell.
Yeah, yeah. It's good fun. I call it, as you know, I call it the Shoal Space Continuum. But one of my favorite things is like, it's actually where Grimm lives. You know, he lives in Hell's version of Blood Tower and things, you know, the Tower of London. But juxtapose is a hodgepodge of time zones. It's, you know, normally each level has its own time and its own space and so on. But in juxtapose, you know, the very name itself, as it suggests, it's, you know, you could be walking along the street, and as you cross the road, you change from, say, a modern day setting to Victorian, to Roman times, back to cave time, you know, things like this. And it, like, and in some of the scenes you write, I've written, you'll see this, like they're pursuing someone and whoop, all of a sudden the buildings are gone, and you're there, but you're in the middle of a swamp. And you know, it makes life quite interesting. It's very good to have that space to play with time being flexible. It's superb.
And pantloads of fun. I like a lot of history and a lot of mythology.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming you like some, because we've spoken about the Roman stuff in your other book for the Nine or the X or whatever. Do you use other mythologies, or are you sticking pretty much to the London-type environment?
Well, most of my setting, what I did, because there's so much to play with, if you go too far, too wide, it spreads you a little thin. So what I've done is try to set each story... although they take place in different levels, like Hellhounds, for example, takes some of the action takes place in juxtapose. Some of it takes place in Hell's version of Paris, or as they call it, Parish. Some across in New Hell. But there's a lot of the action takes place in Parish, and as is depicted on the cover. Sometimes the cover gives it away. In Hellbound, you saw Hell's version of London, the centre of London. And this one, it's Hell's version of Parish. The next one you'll see takes place in New Hell a lot. So you might see the Statue of Lost Liberty in that. But yes, I try to keep things quite level, the playing field. But yes, it does start to delve in. It's more in the next book certain things come out. For example, later on you'll see the djinn, or as they call it, the Al Djinn from Arabic culture. In this one, it's more... to do with developing the story from Hellbound or from Pirates in Hell. Something happened in after Hellbound. The story is followed on in Pirates in Hell, where Grimm was sent on that mission to Skull Island, and it transpires the things or the precious artifacts he wants recovering are the two hellhounds, two in particular who were captured by the Sabiti and kept in prison, in a special prison. He gets them back, and this carries on from there when he's thinking, well, I've got to increase my strength, I've got to ensure now that my team are up to scratch again to face the problems we're facing, because lots of things are happening. The people are trying to escape hell, you've got the Sabiti mixing things up, and of course there's an insane angel on the loose. So for that, I have dipped into different countries, but I just pick at it a little bit in this story, because I have to be conscious of developing the actual overall theme that runs through each adventure.
So just to clarify for people who may not necessarily be very familiar with it, and we are up to about, I think, almost 20 books in the entire series, including yours, plus all the anthologies, plus two or three other side books or whatever that have been done by other authors that are part of that same universe. The Sabiti are in part of the modern Heroes in Hell, and their purpose is to account what's going on in Hell, because Heaven or some bureaucratic in Heaven has decided Hell is not punishing enough, so the Sabiti are down here to mete out more punishment.
Yes,
and Lucifer and the other Hell lords don't like that, and they have their own political agendas going against each other just to take over Hell if they can, and then we have fun.
Yes, I mean, they're auditors, as sons of heaven and earth, they are incredibly powerful. I'm thinking the first time they face off, I can't remember, was it is it in Lawyers or Rogues?
They show first in Lawyers, yes.
Lawyers in the Kigali homeworld with Eshi and I forgot the other lord's name. But yes, it's very interesting that they come there and they face off with Satan. He backs down a little bit, although that doesn't necessarily give away, because remember, he's the arch deceiver, and of course you've got this fermenting hatred, this bitterness, this antagonistic rivalry simmering away in the background. So I've been able to play on that, and of course with this, they're itching to audit on the different realms, so I'm allowing them to do that in my books. They're sniping away on the in the outer realms, as it were, trying to foment a bit of a confrontation, and things gradually build up. They gradually build up, and in Hellhounds, you'll see there is this awesome, absolutely awesome confrontation between a fully empowered Grimm and all seven. I call it that particular chapter, The Maleficent Seven. Ta-da!
I like the name of that. That's pretty good.
Yeah. I know. I was quite pleased with it myself. The Maleficent Seven, yes. I gave myself a cookie for that. Marvellous.
Just one?
Oh, a box.
Should have at least two for that one. That's actually a good name.
thank you. Yeah, it's quite good. And again, but that that's where the rules came out. I made sure that they they acted in the way they're supposed to and things like that. But it created a very, very pivotal scene of the book, and allowed certain other things to happen with Grimm's overall backtail.
Cool. And another side note to throw in about the Heroes in Hell universe is that a lot of the names for places and things are hellified parodies of things. So like you were calling Paris versus Parish. there's New Hell. There's a whole bunch of things that I can't think of off the top of my head. There's hell pads and hell phones that don't always work, or don't always work the way they're supposed to. I love the fact that technology works, but it has sometimes different rules about how that technology works.
Yes.
And in the different corners of hell, or the various hells, and Heroes in Hell, the whole series takes into account, including the various mythologies hell. So we have the Elysium Fields. We have what I've been writing in before, which is the Celtic hell, which name is completely forgetting me right now. We have the Greek hells, we have the Roman hells, we have the Japanese and Chinese hells. I've seen people writing stories in each of those as well, and this is all a beautiful thing. Have you played with any of those others other than
yes
okay
Yeah, I've played with Niflheim.
Niflheim, yes.
Nordic. There's quite a few scenes are set there, especially not so much in Hell. You'll see it go on in the following book, which is going to be entitled Hellgate. Niflheim is quite predominant. What do they call it? Oh, I can't believe it. It's in the next book as well. Say the Elgin. Their version of hell is incredible. The seven different levels of torment, you know, it's absolutely right. Wonderful. I say that comes out more in the next book, so I might wait till then to do it. But yeah, looking into their history and how they, you know, you can see where certain ideas come from, or certain myths come from across cultures. Yes, superb. I won't go on about that now because it's in another book, if you don't mind. But yes.
No, that's fine. So the first book, second book, you've got third book coming out. Is this supposed to be a trilogy, or is this just a continuing series that you're working on and developing as you go?
It will be a continuing series. Well, what I thought I'd do is so that people don't get sick of it, because as you say, there are a lot of books within the Heroes in Hell universe. So what I thought I'd do to keep Grim fresh is introduce his story, so you find out about him in the first three books. Then I'll let it rest a little bit and he'll carry on in the anthologies, but then he'll come back. But there's, how can I say, an interesting twist coming, because in between you're going to find not so much linked, but I suppose it's like a cousin set of paranormal stories coming into that are linked in an interesting way. That's all I'll say at the moment. which are set more on hell or on earth or in between, so it's not part of the Heroes in Hell, although there's a link there that you'll see. And then Grimm's going to come back, because obviously certain evildoers, as you know, in hell, or people die for the most part. Very few are obliterated and wiped out of existence.
Defeats the whole purpose of hell.
Yes, yeah, precisely. They come back. So even though they might have been mutated a little bit or dealt with or lobotomized, you know, the threat is still there. They'll eventually come back and they start their shenanigans again. You know, so it's quite good. But I've got this overall thing that will extend down through the centuries, as it were. So yes, he's going to be coming back.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about specific characters. Damon Grimm. Okay. What's his job and role in this Hell series, in this Hell universe?
Well, Damon Grimm, as you know, hopefully he's named him as, he is the Reaper. He is the Grim Reaper. He reaps souls. He's one of the very, very few characters who can actually go topside. He can go into the land of the living, and he will specifically pick out those who Satan has once down in Hell, perhaps before their time. And indeed that's how the novels set off. In Grimm, he's actually working topside. He's gone to recover something that belongs to his satanic majesty that was stolen from him, as the overall theme of Doctors in Hell brings out. The first novel, Hell Bound, carries on while he's still on earth, winds up his work there, and then comes back to hell. So, you know, he's the Reaper. He takes him in. But he's also the chief, what's called the Hellhound. The Hellhounds are Satan's bounty hunters. Because as you can imagine, with all these different levels, all these different realms in different times, you know, throughout eternity, past, future. Future? Is that a new word? Past?
Future. We're going to pick the future.
Yeah, thank you. Past, future, and present. See, I can say it. You know, there are many, many devious characters that need bringing to heel, because, you know, murder's the number one pastime in hell. Even so, there are certain rules. You have to toe the line. You have to know your place. And with the type of characters that end up there, you know, some of the world's most desperate, despicable despots, as it were, they need a strong hand, and that's what the Hellhounds do. you know, they bring him in. Grimm is the chief hellhound. He is also the leader of Satan's special interrogators, the Inquisitors. You know, and he says, many a scream echoes out across the blackened rooftops of old London town, you know, from from what, you know, we call the Tower of London, but they call it the Den of Iniquity, as his interrogators get to work dismembering those poor damn souls that fall into their clutches. So his job is pretty interesting. It's busy.
And do you have a finite number of the hellhounds, or is it like you know exactly how many you have and who? And
Yeah, that's one of the flexible things. Like, it starts off with three of them. In Hellhounds, you'll see there's Yamato Takaru, which I'll come back to. You know, I'll explain a bit about each one in so there's Yamato Takaru and Champ Ferguson. Those are two of them. Yamato, for example, he's otherwise known as Prince Osu. He's like a first century Japanese ninja warlord, or he was a prince, his father was, but he became a legendary assassin with a legendary sword, and he was undefeated in battle. When he came down to hell, you know, because of his the many people he murdered, his abilities were enhanced, and he is something of an elemental character. The other one is Champ Ferguson, a Confederate bounty hunter, and he is an absolute swine. He's one of these people. Like, when you look at him, this is a great thing. When you look at him, he looks, you know, you think, oh, look at that weedy snot, you know. But he was, but you know, evidently, you know, the history about him says he is one hell of not just a tracker, but he's one of these. He would you know, quite happily smile, shake your hand as he's cutting your ears off and then chewing on them and things. He's a nasty so-and-so. He was crass, he was basic, he's down to the perfect remedy or the perfect material for a hellhound. You know, he was superb. You know, so those are the first ones we meet. Obviously, because of things that happen within the tales, you find that Damon has to, like, increase his strength a little bit. So in Hellhounds, we're introduced to the first woman who's ever become a hellhound.
And who is she?
Her code name is the Lady Gemini. And the reason for that is, if you look at her, one side of her face looks beautiful and normal, but the other side looks like it's withered parchment, you know, that's been left out in the sun and cracked. And it's joined by huge surgical staples, because when she came to hell, she pissed the wrong people off. And the Undertaker, shall we say, has permanently cursed her now, so that, you know, for the rest of eternity, she's got this disfigurement. She's like the Lady Gemini.
Let me stop you there for a second.
Yeah.
Let's explain the Undertaker for a little bit for those people who are not familiar with it, because the Undertaker is a very, very key part of the Heroes in Hell series.
Yes, indeed. He's one of my favorite characters. He's not one of mine, unfortunately, you know, because although I do use him quite a lot, you know, when people die and they are resurrected in hell and what's called Slab A in the mortuary, it depends, you know, I suppose it's done this horrible thing of potluck. They can come back completely normal, or they can come back with their, you know, their arms stitched where their legs are. He can mutate you in all sorts of different ways, and you're sent off on your first assignment. When you die, if you've not pleased Satan well, die, you'll be reassigned. Again, these mutations can take place at any time he wants. So, you know, he can, like some of those who go. One of the places in Grimm's Adventures is called the Cirque du Freak, where those who have displeased Satan are consigned for at least a century. We've got the Inside Out Man. He went through the Undertaker, and when he was reassigned, all his organs are on the outside. They're literally taped to him with black masking tape. So, you know, and he makes him run an assault course of barbed wire, or razor wire, I think you call it across there, and razor blades. You know, it's like, oh, you know. But his job, he keeps discipline, as it were, but he also works out his own particular twisted, perverted desires on those unfortunate enough to come to an untimely end while they're in hell. And of course, that happens a lot.
Well, yeah, a place as big as hell, people die all the time. There's probably 4.2 million people dying every 10 minutes.
Oh, yes, yes.
And that's a lot of work to do for one fellow.
Yes, yeah.
Well, he's got a group.
Yes, yes, his minions. His minions. I've built up a thing that I use within my own story, that where Grimm has quite a few interesting encounters, and his hellhounds do, when they have to go to the Undertaker, because Grimm hates the Undertaker with a passion. The Undertaker obviously can't stand Grimm, you know, because some of the scenes that take place within the mortuary are made, you know, quite funny as well, quite funny, because I enjoy playing them off against each other. So as you'll see in Hellhounds.
Let's get back to Lady Gemini.
Oh, yes, sorry, yes. Oh, yes, she's a lovely character. I thought I'd bring her into it because, as I say, the latest story, he needs to increase his strength. And I thought, you know, let's have an interesting, you know, not just from a woman's perspective, but because a lot of it's set in Paris, let's have you know, a person who knows the French culture well. And her real name is Marie Anne Charlotte de Corday d'Aumont, you know, bit of a mouthful, otherwise known as Charlotte Corday. She was born in 1768 to a minor aristocratic family and lived during the time of the French Revolution. And of course, living at that time, you know, people got caught up in the fervor, all the politics and so on. And she evidently was a sympathizer of one of the movements called the Girondin movement. There were lots of different factions, as it were. And they were particularly persecuted by one of the other factions called the Jacobins, and their leader Jean-Paul Marat really picked on them. Now, for somehow, it doesn't explain exactly why, she targeted him, and on the pretext of giving him intelligence on the Girondins, she met him at his house, it says, but it doesn't explain how she managed to murder him in the bath, because she actually, you know, killed him while he was taking a bath, but it doesn't explain how. She was in the room alone with him in the bath. You can guess why, the supposition's there. But having stabbed him to death, she was then labelled l'ange de l'assassinat, you know, the assassin's angel. So I thought, oh, this is an interesting character. You know, someone who's, you know, she's tough, she's focused, she's sneaky, and you know, obviously has this penchant for stealth and so on. I thought, yeah, she can use that. So obviously I've enhanced her a little bit with what happens to some people in hell. She's incredibly fast, incredibly agile. She becomes an assassin. You know, she takes that on in hell. Obviously, after pissing off the wrong people a few times, the Undertaker permanently disfigured her. And in the intervening months between Pirates in Hell and the beginning of Hellhounds, Grimm has been hunting for people who could possibly make the grade to be Hellhounds, and Bumpf, he's narrowed the margin down to just one, and he watches her at work over a period of time, and then as she carries out her what becomes her final, you know, off-book assassination, he makes the offer, you know, to change her unlife forever, and she becomes the latest Hellhound and the first woman, and she's an absolutely brilliant kick-ass character who has this ability. She can influence insects, she can influence the minds of small animals, and you think, well, yeah, but remember,
oh, dude, hell. I can think of many things to do with that stuff.
Oh, it's fun. It's fun when you see, you get an idea of just how much fun that can be in the prologue as you're introduced to her, and then let's just say it's built on as it goes through the story, and there's a lot of fun with that. A lot of fun indeed. Yeah, great character. I'm going to enjoy using her as, you know, it goes on. She's a good character.
So other than the three main hellhounds and the Undertaker, do you have any other major regular characters that you have bring through your stories?
Let's have a think now. Well, yeah, we refer to the Undertaker quite a bit, and of course there are an odd pair, shall we say, who these two are trying to escape out. You've got Chopin, you know, the actual
composer.
The composer. He is my character. And Tesla, Nikola Tesla, who I'm not sure exactly who Nikola belongs to, but these two have been working in league for a time. Nikola, as you know, he was sick and tired of in life. A lot of people don't know just how much Nikola Tesla did, because Edison, they say, took all the glory. But once he arrived in hell, Tesla got sick and tired of that. You know, and now he's in hell. He's out to show, look, look what I can do. But as you know, there's this twist in hell that of, you know, things happen to them. Tesla, although he's brilliant, can't actually build any of his inventions himself, because if he does, they'll explode in his face. So in a magnificent twist, Edison is their slave. And so, as he did in life, he says, here you go, you take my work, you build it. And that's Edison's punishment. Now he has to build all these brilliant inventions that Tesla's coming up with, and they work beautifully, you know. So that's quite good. With Chopin, you know, he was an absolute maestro who in later life was struck by this terrible form of dementia. So all this brilliance in his mind, you know, these things he could compose virtually, you know, off the cuff. You know, he lost the ability to be able to express it. In hell, what I did, I compounded that. So, you know, he's been tormented by this. Like, he'll come up with the concept of a new masterpiece, but as he starts to play it, his fingers will break, because in real life he used to get these terrible spasms that would, you know, literally break his bones. That sometimes they could be that severe, or, you know, so I thought, yeah, we could compound that in hell. Whatever he starts, he cannot finish. So they're both, you know, desperately trying to get around this, because they're sick and tired of what's happening. They want out. They want others to know about that. They want glory. And, you know, so these two, that doesn't sound like they cause a lot of trouble, Tesla, Chopin, but my goodness, when you think about it, yes, they do. And it's absolutely wonderful thinking of how, you know how they can really piss Satan off. You know, they are a thorn in his side. And of course, when Grimm's trying to deal with this type of thing and like deal with the Subiti, you know, it's just one long grind after another. And, you know, it's no wonder he wants to just take heads, as he does sometimes. You just go off and he'll just decimate a city full of people just to ease a bit of stress. So they're two very good characters.
Well, and of course, put it easily, you just kill them all and let the Undertaker sort them out.
Oh, yes. We could do, but where's the fun in that?
Come exactly.
On. Yeah. And of course, then we've got a fictional character that I introduced in it, the Angel Grislington.
I was going to ask you about that one.
Oh, go on.
Yeah, keep going.
He's superb. He's superb. Like, he was introduced in Hellbound near the end of the story, in that one of the ways that Chopin and Tesla are looking at to get out of hell is by use of this miraculous substance called seraphonite. And although Grislington isn't a seraphim, he is a cherub of God that they managed to capture at the time of the last battle that sundered heaven from hell. And, you know, there were casualties on both sides. He was a captive angel, and they've kept him on this special island called Cog Isle, which is outside the Shoal Space Continuum, if you like. It's out of time, out of place. There are only special times of the year that you can get there. There are special ciphers and keynotes, you know. Think of He-Man comes, you know, Stargate. There's only certain ways you can get there. But he is the possessor of one of the Seraphim swords, or Vidium swords, as they call it. Each sword does a different thing. And to tease him, not only did Satan have him incarcerated in this isolated cell deep in the bowels of the underworld, but his sword is encased within a special stone just out of reach. It's there. But this sword is the sword of celestial arches. It can open a portal to anywhere. That's how angels move about quickly. And of course, he's kept this thing out. Well, you know, at the end of Hellbound, as readers will know, Grislington escaped his time in captivity, and especially in isolation, has driven him absolutely nuts. So instead of fleeing to home, as you imagine he would do, he's thinking, well, you know, what is this place? What's it got to offer? And as you see in the story in Hellhounds, he sets out to examine everything that hell has to offer. And he seems to be enjoying it, as you'll find out.
And while he's floating about, he has that sword?
Oh, maybe? Yes. Yeah, he does.
Okay.
He does have the sword. As you say, because he wants, the concept of the story is he wants to experience what hell has to offer, you know, he doesn't even try to use it. He's just more intent on stirring things up because it's more fun.
Well, yeah.
is absolutely nuts now. What? And, you know, he doesn't think twice about creating confrontations and so on, because he is, even though he's nuts and incredibly polite and English and pip, you know, he's nuts. He's an out-and-out killer.
So as a cherub, he wouldn't exactly have much to compare against. And if he was a cherub during the War of the Fallen, he would only have heaven and that war to compare against, right?
That's right. That's right. Yes. Of course, he hasn't got his wings, so that adds an interesting twist that you'll find is developed as well. Because without the wings, it creates an imbalance in their makeup, in their psyche, and this is part of the problem, which is addressed in Hellhounds in a very interesting way.
Cool. Well, from most of the discussion that you've been spending the last little while, I would be inclined to believe that you have a very well thought out environment, characterization, storylines, and the whole. It seems like you like a lot of details.
I think it's important to have it in the background. I don't refer to it all, but it's there because it adds that touch of realism. You know, if it's well grounded out and, you know, you've got those details that you can call on, it just, even though we're talking about this, you know, the fantasy, it adds that touch of realism when it shows, yes, they have a history, they have a background, you know, it's, yeah.
Now,
I think it's important.
In that same vein, do you consider yourself more a fantasy author or a horror author?
Myself?
Yes.
Fantasy, I would say, because I don't specifically go out to write horror, but what I try to do is but I try to stay true to the nature of the stories I write. This series, you know, it's set in hell. If it were an out and out horror story, I don't think you could have as much fun as I do by, you know, adding that fantastical element into it. I mean, you know, you still got your smiling assassins, you still got your out and out brutes, you know, whose, you know, main function is to twist your neck on and sup from your neck. You know, it's I think I would say fantasy more than horror. I enjoy that. I'm always out there. My mind is always out there. So I would say fantasy more than horror.
Okay. And another part of that concept is, how much of real life do you incorporate into the writing, and how much of the writing do you bring out to the real life? I mean, being a horror writer myself, I frequently get caught, hey, you write that scary stuff, right?
Yeah.
So do you guys really do that stuff? No.
Do you? Oh, I just haven't been caught. No.
Oh, okay.
It's... I've got an incredibly vivid imagination.
Hence, being a writer.
Yeah. But I always have done. I've had an interesting childhood. You know, I grew up in a real life, genuine haunted house. I was
nice.
Plagued, if you like. Although I didn't look on it as being plagued, by recurring dreams. Like I know when I dream. I dream a lot. I can control my dreams. But as a child, growing up in this haunted house, I had recurring dreams of a certain nature for quite a few years. And when I say recurring, it's not every now and again. It would be at least 3-4 times a week where my dreams would start off in a certain way, along this tunnel full of eyes staring at me as I float along. You know, it wasn't until I got old enough I'd turn around and face them that it changed into a different context. So and things come to me in dreams. I've dreamed of or characters have come from very vivid dreams, and because I immerse myself into them a lot, I suppose what I say, a lot of this comes from my fantasy. But once I start thinking about a thing, I put myself in it. You know, when I go to bed at night, I start living it as if I was there. So there is that element of realism to it. If you understand, you know, I put, like with Grimm, when I started developing his stories, I didn't just think, oh, Grimm does this, Grimm. Right, now I'm Grimm, you know, as I'm going to sleep, I'm thinking, oh, I would deal with this and I would do that. So I immerse myself within the characters, and so I can, you know, face the hurdles they face, overcome the problems they have as if it was me or as if I was in their shoes. So yes, I personalize quite a lot of it, but how I would do it. And of course, because I've had an interesting life, if you like, you know, from childhood, what I did when I was in the military and so on, I can add, you know, a lot of, you know, I've seen some terrible things, and so on, and yeah, I try to keep things, you know, there's that expression, keep it real. And when you keep it real, again, it has that element of truth to it, even if it's fantasy, even if it's horror, the more realistic you can make it, the better. So I try to inject that, you know, from, you know, my own experiences or how I would face that situation. Yeah, hopefully that answers it nicely, but yeah.
Yeah, it does. That was pretty clear for me. I got most of it.
Yeah.
So, continuing on with the idea about how the writing and whatever, do you have a particular place you go to start writing this stuff? I mean, obviously, every writer has a different way of approaching their methods and how and what they do. I mean, is it specific environments, is it specific environment variables like music and stuff that you use to get you in the mood to do stuff?
I'm not one of these straightforward guys. Like, for example, when I'm writing, I need absolute silence. I have to have silence because, for example, I enjoy certain types of music, but if I have music on when I'm writing, I'll start listening along to it. It'll be a distraction. I like to immerse myself in the character, you know, so I'm there, I'm smelling it, I'm hearing it, I'm touching it, I'm living and sweating, you know, I'm in the moment. However, to get myself in the mood, I do listen to certain types of music to create the right mood, to create the right impression, like Nightwish, Disturbed, Green Day, you know, Evanescence, you know, those type of groups are superb for the Hell series. I mean, the lyrics of some of their stories, the atmosphere that they create through their music is very good. And when it comes to the writing, I'm one of these, you know, I've got my outline that I like to do. So I sketch down sometimes. I write out a rough guy, right? Like, I want to cover this today. It starts to go down in writing. And then when I'm doing a semi edit of that, just to see how it flows, then I have that type of music on in the background at that stage. And again, because that creates this atmosphere that I want, how twisted or, you know, how warped and out there it is, and then right, and it just makes sure I've got those elements added into it, and then I, you know, finish it off and polish it, you know, so that I've got these what I would call like a painter's, there's different washes, different layers that you add on, and at certain layers, yes, I do listen to music, I, you know, create the right movement, but other times, especially during the creative stage, I like it silent, and it has to be silent, and that's when I get most work done.
Okay. Indoor or outdoor writing?
Indoor. Indoor. I say if I was outdoor again, I'd end up, Yeah, so I do like to study things. I tend to like become absorbed in them. And so indoors.
Okay. Mm. I'm a little weirder. I absolutely have to have chaos running around me while I'm writing. Yeah, it's a weird thing. It's like if I don't have stimuli, my sitting spot, yeah. I look up, I look around, there are multiple points of stimuli and distraction. But in the same vein, when I'm actually writing, I don't hear any of it. So it's like I said, every writer has a different way to approach how they do it and what they're doing. So I'm always curious about how other people do it.
Yeah, it's odd, you know, you just get comfortable with your own method. I mean, I can do that when I'm doing notes, you know, I carry a notebook quite a lot, and like sometimes an entire scene, and I started, and I can ignore absolutely everything that's going on around me. But when it comes to getting it down, I like it to flow. I like it to, you know, you think of those little, like a gem, you think of the bits that you can cut and polish, and so the many facets of it come out with just an odd reference here, a little, you know, tweak there, and it's like, boom, I need the silence for that. And but as you say, everyone's different, and that's just the way I work. Some people think, oh, you do quite a lot, you know, all these different layers, but, you know, that's just the way I do it. You know, like yours, I couldn't do what you do with people around me. I'd be shouting, I'd go, shut up! You know, I would kill, you know, if that happened to me, but there you go.
So the household knows when you're in writing mode, stay away.
Yes, I have my own area, shall we say, that's utter silence or else.
Utter silence or else, you'll be a character in the book and we shall kill you. Again and again and again and again and again and again. Because what the hell else is hell without having some torture?
This is true.
Yes. So have you ever considered or even done yet? Because one of the things about the Heroes in Hell series has been the collaborative effort of two or three authors working together on a story or combining their characters from one story to the other. Have you ever given any thought to combining or working with any of the other authors in the series?
I've worked at a distance with some, in that we've collaborated a little bit, but because I'm not a full-time author yet, I work and I work different shifts, so my time for writing is extremely limited, so I have to write when I can, so to speak. So that time is very precious. So, and of course, if you're doing a collaboration, it means you'd have to try and make adjustments like, for example, now we're chatting and it's for me, it's nearly 2 a.m. in the morning. So it would be very different, say, if I was like trying to collaborate with you. It would, you know, because you, if you're going to collaborate, you've got to do it properly. The story would have to gel. It would have to, you know, look natural, and it'd be very, very, very difficult to do. So I haven't done like a full collaboration. I actually have one or two offers from different authors, you know, in the past, you know, would you like to do a shared piece? And, you know, yes, I'd love to, but my circumstances don't allow me to do it. And perhaps one day when I've got more time, a collaboration is something that's on the cards, but sadly not at the moment.
Cool. Well, I know Janet likes the collaborative works because it gives it a little bit more dynamic aspect to it, where you got one author doing a thing, you got another author doing a thing, and that story just gels together, the two of them.
Yes. I mean, I've done it with one or two other writers, and they say, well, what are you doing this time? And I'm saying, give them a brief précis of what's happened. So they make a reference to my story, I'll make a reference to theirs. But that's it. But as to an actual close-up collaboration, no, I haven't sadly had the time for that. Okay. I'd like to. It's nice, because to say that whole concept of gelling and making everything tied together, I think it would add that bit of polish. It would make it truly shine.
Well, I'm going to ask you something offline later.
Okay.
Which we're not going to include in the interview here because
okay.
Secrets, man. It's all about secrets. So, in similar views, now we'll get into some nuts and bolts type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You, from what I've been able to see, you've got a bit of a focus on the marketing aspect of what you're trying to present from your work.
Yes, I try to. I don't think I'm all that good at it, but try to. I try to do my best.
Okay, and like, what kind of things are you working on to try and maximize the impact? Because I hear a lot of different things from a lot of different people for different aspects of things, both as an author and as a business. Because I'm integrated with so many different things. A lot of people try to focus and fixate on Facebook and Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about using both of those platforms to market your product, as it were?
Well, I do to the best of my ability. But what I find is, like, I think sometimes you can be your own best judge. Now, being a member of various groups, sometimes you go onto, for example, Facebook, and it is absolutely deluged. You know, there's an absolute glut of it there, and you just can't read it all. So I'm thinking, now if I try that approach, my advert, is my little post just going to disappear? You know, is it going to be like looking at a brick wall? You know, it's all those thousands of bricks in there, you know, that you mm-hmm. don't. So you've got to make that brick stand out. So promoted posts I found a little bit more effective, mm-hmm. or finding the right group. Again, because the right groups seem to have a good working ethic, where you're reaching the right people. Like Twitter, there's different times of the day. I'm very conscious of the fact, since I moved here to Greece, that the time difference, like between myself and you. Mm-hmm. So if I put Twitter posts, I do like in little blasts of three for each storyline, but I'll do them morning, afternoon, evening. So, you know, I can hopefully reach different customers. I try to make them punchy. I try to add a visual aspect to it. And I think one of the other things I've done is, as we've all done, right, you try, I'll go on that blog, I'll try this person who said they offer these services. You find someone or, you know, an outlet that works, like Rafflecopter is what, like a famous one that people seem to use a lot. You know, you write, you put this advert on and people agree to support that post at a certain time and a certain date, and boom, out it comes. And while it's concentrated, you need to, as it were, extend that type of concentration really to make an impact. So what I've tried to do is, as I've gone along, you know, because I've been writing about five years now, something like that, 6 years, is right, I've noted those that seem to work or be more effective, and, you know, stuck with them, and at the same time look out for different views. Then I make it specific. For example, with the ninth is a science fiction series. It's to do with different military units as well, so it's military sci-fi. So my promotions there are geared more to the military, law enforcement, and the sci-fi geeks, whereas this one are like, I have certain adverts or posts running with various gothic magazines, because there is a very gothic dark setting to it, and that seems to do them quite well as well. So, you know, you've got to be genre specific. You've got to target the right niche, so that, you know, there's only so much you can do, and you've got to ensure that what you do is more effective, you know, so you're not just like, you know, wasting your blows, as it were.
Yeah, bang for your buck.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you don't want to spend $300 to make $30 in sales.
Precisely. You know, it's it is that. Now, when I first came out, when I first started to write, I knew, like, I'm just one of many. Okay, I've got a certain degree of talent. I'm going to improve, and I have been improving. So what I did do then is, like, I didn't mind spending quite a lot on promotions. It's just to get my name known.
Right.
I wasn't expecting to, you know, like, comebacks, as that, but I just wanted to get my name out there. Now, it seems to be paying off, because, like, you know, some of the people who have contacted me and, you know, doing like a request or thing, like on Twitter, like the Expanse crews, you know, the Expanse the Expanse,
the TV show,
those people, you know, they're requesting for me to be friends. It's like, wow, yeah. People off shows like Buffy and Vampire Diaries and things like that, and you're thinking, whoa. You know, so it's such a noise. And of course, this has a knock-on effect. Certain producers, certain directors, you know, that's starting to happen now, especially within the last 12 months. It's like, something's right. You know, so keep it selective. You know, it's, go on, sorry.
No, sorry, I didn't want to interrupt. You'll like, because I have a name for that specific element of activity. I call it the density effect. And it only applies to social media and all of the electronic online forum stuff. Is the more that you are out there, the more that you're diversifying how you are experienced or exposed or seen, the more it feeds itself.
Yeah. Suppose. But what I also do then is just try, like, I've noticed, like, for example, on Twitter, some people have thousands upon thousands of followers. Well, I don't think, it's nice. But how can you, you know, as it were, serve them or, you know, represent or, you know, be interested with thousands of thousands. So I weed mine down quite a lot to those who I'm, you know, very, very active with, certain groups, certain people, like, and especially people like the Expanse crew and stuff. You know, you keep to those who you're active with and interact with quite a lot. Weed it down, because that way then it shows that you're aware of each other, you're conscious of what each other are doing, and, you know, that interest, I think, in the long run will, you know, it will pay off.
Mm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, with Perseid Press.
Yes.
That being the imprint that has been publishing both of the Heroes in Hell books.
Yeah.
Did they also print any of the other books?
Yeah, the ninth, or what's becoming the ninth series, they've so far done the ninth and Exordium of Tears. At the beginning of next year, we'll have the final one of the that particular trilogy, Prelude to Sorrow, is out. Although other works are in the line with that, fans have asked, you know, for other things. So,
by the way, I've like that name.
Oh, thank you.
Prelude to Sorrow, I like that name.
Oh, yes. And it, so we say, not only does it bring things full circle, but there's another aspect to it that will, people will see. It's like, I like to, like that final reveal, as you were, like, as will happen with Damon Grimm. You know, there's that final reveal. I give snippets out. I know what's going to happen. And then there's that twist at the end. It's like, it's not just the head coming off the neck twist. Some lovely twist. You've got to add that, ba-ba, and it's, thank you.
Wonderful. So, in the next 6 minutes we've got left, 5 minutes we've got left, couple of recommended readings that got you to where you are as far as being a fantasy style author.
Right.
Couple of quick ones, not the whole rundown of these 400 authors, because I used to read.
In books,
yeah.
If you like, or films, or in books, like the best way to describe it is ones I followed for many, many years. I think the Thomas Covenant series by Stephen Donaldson.
Yep.
I came across him quite by chance many, many years, 1978, I think. Mm-hmm. And I love his writing. He's a wordsmith, superb. Raymond D. Feast,
yep,
with the Magician series, absolutely excellent. I followed him for years. Those two, I would say, I followed for the longest. I also, Tad Williams, Trudy Canavan, Terry Brooks is quite good. I like Grisham, believe it or not. because there's elements of him. I like the way he goes, his detail, when he get things right. Mm-hmm. I've certainly included that within rhythm of writing. So in a nutshell, I'll just leave it with those.
Well, yeah. Speaking of Terry Brooks, have you seen the Shannara Chronicles, the TV series?
I saw the first one. I believe the second one's out, although it looks like he came in really with Elfstones. It was more the story of the Elfstones as opposed to the sword of Shannara, wasn't it?
Yeah, bit and then made a smaller part and then expanded out the much farther books, which I never read.
Because I started off with that one. I must admit, the Sword of Shannara, all those many years ago. 1978, 79. Yep. So, or was it 89? Something like that when it first came out. And I quite liked them because it was just a trilogy then when it first came out.
A trilogy of a trilogy plus a quadrilogy a syntology or whatever you want to call it.
Although what I did find quite interesting, I started reading a few more of his recently to see how the world of Shannara came about. That was interesting, coming from now into the near future after the Third World War and how it gradually evolved. I did find that series quite interesting because it links in with Running with a Demon, the Knights of the Word series he did. So that was quite interesting. Yes, it's not bad, the TV thing. I find it quite entertaining if you take it with a pinch of salt, because you often find that the books are far, far superior to what appears on. They are.
Yeah. The TV series I found to be light but fun.
Yeah, yeah, yes, it is. But the books are obviously much, much better.
Oh, absolutely. So
go on. Sorry. Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry. If only they'd do that with Stephen Donaldson. Good grief! Could you imagine?
I could not imagine them bringing the Tales of Covenant, Thomas Covenant, into a TV or book format unless it was like maybe a 10-year arc, 4 movies just for the first trilogy, and he's got in that series 12 books or something like that.
There are lots.
Yeah, there's a lot there. And each of those books is not small. They're like good 400, 500-page books, which is your normal book at that time is 300 pages.
Voluminous, yes.
Voluminous is a good way to describe it. And I'll be the same. I actually was reading those books as they came out.
Yeah, yeah. Same here.
Lovely stuff. Lovely stuff.
Yes, yeah.
Now, in the last 2 minutes we have...
Okay.
Sell yourself. Where can people find you, and how do they get to hold and connect and follow and do all that fun stuff?
Facebook, Andrew P. Weston, you'll find me on Facebook, although and if you look into that page itself, you'll see there are lots of other little sub pages, because Grimm has his own page, the Ninth has its own page. You can find me on Twitter, of course, it's but under Weston Andrew. And when you go into those, they'll link into my blogs and into my website. My website is, as my name is, andrewpweston.com, simple as that. And from there, it'll just link you into everything else. It's a simple way of saying it to save inundating people with lots of information, andrewpweston.com. And it'll link you through to everything else, what I'm doing, what's currently going on, and where you can find me.
Wonderful. Well, mm-hmm. Andrew, thanks again, once again, for coming on the show and talking to us about Heroes in Hell and Hellhounds and Hellbound.
Thank you. It's been fun. The time has gone really quickly. I can't believe how quick that's gone. Cool.
I was going to say, that hour has just gone by lickety-split.
Yeah. Yep. It's like hell. There's like a time delay.
No continuous form of time.
This is true.
So everybody else in After All On, thanks for joining us and hearing, chatting and hearing and listening to us talk about stuff. Be back here every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Listen to the insanity that is After Rot. Everybody, have fun and be the after-rottingest After Rot that you can rotting be.
Of a big surprise, if you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their fill.